You're listening to the History Nerd Podcast. I am a high school history teacher who teaches her students to investigate the facts for themselves and decide what they think happened. That's what I want to do here. I'll present you with facts and occasionally my opinion, but I want you to decide for yourself what you think happened. Just as a note, I do my best to research each story in full, but I may miss things here or there. I strive to use the most trustworthy sources and information I can find and give you my best judgment where things aren't clear, but I'm not a professional historian. All right, let's get started. So my inspiration and a lot of my information for this episode comes from the book Killers of the Flower Moon by David Grant. You guys, read this book. I seriously could not put it down. If you are interested in what you hear in this episode and you want the nitty-gritty details, you need to check this book out. The best part of it all, to me, is that not only is it history, but it qualifies as a true crime story. It's actually the very first case the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover took that really put them on the map. After this case is when the FBI was officially and formally formed because of what we're going to talk about today. While I was reading this book, I honestly cannot believe that this is a true story because it is wild. Now, before we get started, I usually teach my students to have historical empathy, meaning they shouldn't judge people from the past without placing themselves in their shoes and trying to determine why they made the decisions that they made. But honestly, the villains in this story, like, I had a really hard time even wanting to be empathic with them, much less placing myself in their shoes, because these guys are the worst of the worst, at least in my opinion. It's tricky because their families are still around and I don't want to offend anyone, but it is really hard to have any kind of sympathy or empathy for these guys. You'll see what I mean. So our story starts with the Osage Nation. Now, I had to go look up how to pronounce Osage because I was pronouncing it Osage when I read the book, but it is actually pronounced Osage. The Osage were a group of Native Americans that, like so many others, were booted around the country by the U.S. government and ended up on this awful piece of land in Oklahoma. It was super rocky, so they couldn't really farm there, and there just wasn't a lot of natural resources. That is, until oil was discovered. I can't find an exact date of when oil was discovered, but it seems to be in about the 1890s to around 1901. As you can imagine, this made the Osage filthy rich. Seriously, the wealth of the Osage Nation combined from the oil sales was more than that of all of the wealth gained during the American Gold Rush total. Today, it would be worth over about $400 million. So my first thought was instant karma, biatches. I have to watch what I say because my mom and grandma listen to this podcast. But seriously, you move these people around, finally stick them on what you think is a patch of worthless land, and then boom, literally, oil is discovered and they become millionaires. The Osage were so wealthy that they all had cars chauffeured by white people most of the time. As you can imagine, that probably chaps some white people hides. They had servants and big houses and were extremely wealthy. Life seemed good for the Osage, and for us looking back, it honestly seems like justice had been served. Things weren't as great as they seemed, however. Of course, the U.S. government had to step in and be obnoxious. I'm a patriotic American for sure, but even I was super bugged by what the U.S. government did here. They basically created the horror the Osage would later endure. Each Osage Indian had what was called a head right. According to the Osage Nation website, in 1906, the Osage Nation was named the beneficial owner of the Osage Mineral Estate. A head right is basically the right to receive a quarterly distribution of funds from the mineral estate. At this time in history, the Osage, who originally lived on the lands that the oil was discovered on, each received a head right. If family members died or passed away, other family members could inherit their head rights. That's super important later on, so remember that. The lame thing that the U.S. government did, however, was require that each Osage be under the care of what they called a guardian. You can't see me doing air quotes here, but I am. These so-called guardians were influential white men who lived in the area. The Osage couldn't withdraw or use their own funds without the approval of these guardians, which is ridiculous. Many Osage were married to white people in the area, and these white men seemed to be the pillars of the society. In Grand's book, he follows the story of Molly Burkhart, who was married to a white man named Ernest Burkhart. He was the guardian of her head right. Things start to unravel, however, when several Osage started to turn up dead. It actually started with the murder of Molly's sister, Anna. She was found in a ravine outside of town, having been shot in the back of the head. On the same day, another member of the tribe named Charles Whitehorn was also murdered, shot execution style. The community was outraged, and many of the men, Osage and white, formed little vigilante groups to try to solve the crimes. A white man named William Hale, who lived in the area and was actually Molly's husband's uncle, even paid for private investigators to take on the case. Hale was rich by his own means, having a successful cattle ranch, among other business investments. Shortly after Anna's death, Molly's mother died, and then her other sister, Rita, and Rita's husband, Bill, were killed when their house exploded. It was clear that someone was not only after the Osage, they were also after Molly's family specifically. A string of murders continues to plague the Osage. In total, 27 members of the Osage tribe were killed between 1921 and 1927. This era became known as the Reign of Terror. People were being picked off one by one, seemingly for no reason. Several lawyers had tried to help, but had either given up or, as would come to light later, been paid off to keep quiet. Others actually lost their lives trying to help the Osage. One of these was W.W. Vaughn, an attorney who was investigating the case. He was killed himself in 1923 when supposedly he got too close to solving the murders. In June 1923, Vaughn was called to the bedside of one of his friends, George Bighart. George Bighart was dying, and it was suspected that he had been poisoned. He had something he wanted to say, but he would only say it to Vaughn because he trusted Vaughn. Before he left, Vaughn had told his wife of a secret place he had hidden some evidence in case something should happen to him. When Vaughn got to the hospital where George was dying, George made everyone else leave the room. No one knows for sure what information George shared, but Vaughn stayed with him until his death. As soon as George died, Vaughn called the sheriff and told him he had some incriminating evidence. He then went to the train station and boarded an overnight train. But when that train arrived at the destination, Vaughn was not on it. He had seemingly disappeared. Grand says about his death, quote, "The Boy Scouts, whose first troop in the United States was organized in Pawhuska, Oklahoma in 1909, joined the search for Vaughn. Bloodhounds hunted for his scent. 36 hours later, Vaughn's body was spotted lying by the railroad tracks 30 miles north of Oklahoma City. He'd been thrown from the train, his neck was broken, and he'd been stripped virtually naked. The documents Bighart had given him were gone, and when Vaughn's widow went to the designated hiding spot, it had been cleaned out," end quote. Absolutely heartbreaking when one of the good guys gets murdered like this. Another attorney trying to help had been murdered in Washington, D.C., while he was actually appealing for congressional help. The Osage had applied to the national government several times trying to get help. The government eventually sent out some agents from the Bureau of Investigation, which was later renamed the Federal Bureau of Investigation. These agents messed up big time, however, mishandling evidence and actually letting one of the key suspects slash informants escape. Because of this, the reign of terror continued until J. Edgar Hoover took over the Bureau of Investigation in 1924. Hoover cleaned house, getting rid of lazy and corrupt agents, and appointed lawman Tom White to take over the case. Tom White was a stud muffin cowboy. He had worked as a Texas Ranger for a little bit, and he was reliable and smart. He's kind of what you would think of when you think of a hero of the old Wild West. Tom assembles a team of other agents who all go undercover to try and discover who was behind all the murders of the Osage Indians. White and his team decide to look at who is inheriting money from all of these deaths. Molly Burkhart had inherited a ton of money, and she had actually disappeared from society. Many thought she was living in fear that she was going to be the next target. Her husband told everyone she was dying from diabetes, but as it later turns out, she was actually being poisoned. Had Molly died, her husband would have inherited all her money, including those head rights she had inherited from her mother and sisters who had all passed away. Luckily, in the nick of time, the killers are caught and the murders stop. Unfortunately, the conspiracy runs really deep and money is power.
That's crazy, just because, I don't know, just especially like with recent like happenings with the whole Epstein thing. But I mean, he had a lot of money and he was able to get away with a lot of things. And I know this has nothing to do with it, but I mean, like this was going on like exactly 100 years ago. So it's just, it's crazy, like, you know, but I, obviously it's just always been a thing. So
yeah, definitely throughout history, the rich have had more power. So I actually hesitate to share who the killers end up being, mostly because I really want you to go read the book. Just know that the book goes into a lot more detail and will literally have you on the edge of your seat because it's so well written. This is not an ad for the book. I just loved it that much.
Question, could I download it and listen to it at work?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you could. All
right, then there we go.
The evidence and money trail lead back to none other than William Hale, Molly's husband's uncle, and the wealthy so-called king of the Osage Hills. He had been pretending to help, all the while orchestrating the murders behind the scene. Molly's husband himself is implicated, but turns on his uncle and tells the truth. As attorneys are preparing to take the case to trial, however, Hale uses every means he has available to him to bribe officials, judges, and lawmen. Eventually, however, Hale ends up being convicted and is sentenced to life in prison, but is paroled in 1942, which disgusts me. He was responsible for so many deaths. Yeah,
but I mean, like, you gotta think about it. It's especially around that time. I mean, you're a white guy. They're not white people, so it's just,
unfortunately, kind of how it was.
Mm-hmm. And it sucks. It's not right.
The Osage had pled with the state of Oklahoma, the state of Kansas, and other agencies to prevent the release of Hale, but to no avail. After Ernest's confession and subsequent cooperation with law enforcement, Molly divorces him. Up to the point where he went on trial and actually confessed, she had stood by her husband. Luckily, she does go on to remarry, but I can't imagine the pain she must have lived with knowing her own husband had betrayed her and tried to kill her and her family. Ernest was sentenced to life in prison and was sent to Oklahoma State Penitentiary, but was released in 1959 and actually received a formal pardon from the governor of Oklahoma in 1966.
Oh my gosh.
Wow. Right. So that is my quick summary of the Reign of Terror and the murder of the Osage Indians in the 1920s. If you enjoyed this episode, again, you have to read the book. Like I said, it is so well written and well researched, and it goes into a lot more detail, including how the Osage feel about everything today. What happened to the Osage makes me sick, and I wish there was something I could do to make up for it, even though I wasn't involved. I don't believe in holding people accountable for things their ancestors did because they can't control that, but I'm sure glad none of my ancestors were involved in this. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. We really enjoy doing this, and your support means the world. You can subscribe on Spotify and be sure to leave a 5-star review. We will be on Apple Podcasts in a few weeks, so look for it there. In the meantime, keep waiting for the next episode, and we can't wait to share what we've researched with you.